Hi, this is James. It's a big travel week as F1 moves across the globe to start the season in Melbourne. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to revisit a podcast from November, which looks at how F1 teams use data in comparison with Premier League football teams. We'll be back next week to look at how that first Grand Prix in Melbourne of 2025 played out.
When Felipe Massa came to us in Ferrari, Formula One, so he was like the lead engineer on his car, and he said to me, he made a statement that he said, look, I think I can be quick everywhere, but I can't be quick in Monaco. And it was a whole data-driven exercise that actually got him to 2 years later pole position and almost winning the race.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week we've got something a little bit special. We're going to look at how Formula One teams use data in comparison with the way top Premier League football teams use it. Now, data is central to success in both sports today, and the smartest teams use it for recruitment, for strategy in play, and tactical decision making, and so much more. With me to discuss this, I have two real experts in their field. From Formula One, Rob Smedley, former race engineer to Felipe Massa at Ferrari, head of track engineering at Williams, and who now runs the Smedley Group, which advises across the F1 spectrum on data and AI. And I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Ian Graham of Ludonautics, formerly at Tottenham Hotspur, but what matters much more to me is that he was for 12 years, Ian?
11.
11 years, head of data at Liverpool Football Club, my club, the club I support. His data analysis played a key role in building the Jurgen Klopp team that won the Premier League and the Champions League. And his book, How to Win the Premier League, is an absolutely fascinating read. Anybody who likes sports or football, and particularly anyone who's interested in the data story, should absolutely read this book. Well, welcome to you both, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks. You. Thanks for having us.
Let's start with a really simple question, because I like to approach things in a simple way. How important is data in sport as we sit here today in 2024, and how much has it changed from 10 years ago?
It's important. It's not the most important thing in sport, but in football in particular, it was just not important 12, certainly 15 years ago. Relevant data didn't exist. The raw materials weren't there to say anything sensible about the sport. But, you know, as data collection technologies improved, computer vision technologies improved, relevant data started being collected. When the raw materials are there, you can start to analyse that data and make an impact. So it's still got a long way to go in football. It's the most difficult sport to analyse using data. But compared to 10 years ago, it just wasn't really used. So we're light years ahead of 2012.
I mean, I think for us, for Formula One, applies a sport to its technology, right? It flips around the standard of sport and data. So for us, for Formula One, it's always been incredibly important. And I think if you go back 15 years ago, which would be what, 2010, it already taken on a massive relevance. You know, I think when I started in Formula One in the mid 90s, it was just starting to become important. I don't think anybody really knew. We already collected more data than probably any other sport, but nobody really knew how to manipulate and drive insight from that data. And I think that's probably what my generation did for Formula One, if we did anything. So we almost ruined it in the early 2000s, if you remember, when we completely controlled the cars and did everything from the pit wall. That was great fun. So I think it's always been important, and it's always been at the heart of Formula One. But I also agree with, I think Ian made a great point there, is it's, you know, even though data is possibly at a higher level of importance in Formula One than it is in football, it's still not the most important thing, right? It's still not
it's still about people, human beings.
It's still about human beings, right? Yeah, people turn on the TV to see human beings in jeopardy. And, you know, that's still the case in both sports.
Ian, tell us how a Premier League team uses data when you talk about player recruitment. Obviously, that's one of the things you're most known for. You were looking out there for some hidden gems, you know, people that other people hadn't spotted, and you're responsible for, you know, bringing in the likes of Mo Salah and all these players who've gone on to be absolute icons. How does that work when you talk about recruitment, and which particular signings are you most proud of?
I think it's important to say that the data was partly responsible. So players need to tick a lot of boxes if they're going to be a successful player. The data box is one box that had to be ticked at Liverpool, but the personality of the player, you know, the things that aren't included in the data, they're really important.
The soft stuff.
Yeah,
soft
and scouts still have an important part to play in that recruitment process. But what data did was to really like democratise recruitment. Insofar as in the old days before you had data, you had, you know, the scouts or the manager's opinion was all you had to go on. And so much importance was given to the context of the players' games. So did he play in the Premier League already? Did he know what it was like to play on a wet Wednesday night in Stoke? Because, you know, so if you get a soft foreigner coming over here, they might not understand what it means. And, you know, football is refereed differently in the UK than it is abroad. So those things are important to some extent. But what we can do with data is to, you know, measure how important wet Wednesdays on Stoke are and how important that is compared to 2 or 3 years of consistently good performances that those players have put in Italy or Germany or Portugal or wherever it might be. And so it really opened up the ability to look at hundreds of players on an even playing field and without any prejudices coming in as to the player's background or experience or, you know, his body language in the game. Yes, that can be important, but how important is it compared to what they've actually done on the pitch for the last 3 years? So it really opened up. Yeah, we can look at hundreds and hundreds of players with data. It's not as perfect a view. I would say if you want to look at one game, I'd much prefer a scout watches one game than you look at the data generated by one game.
Yeah, you need a bigger set, don't you?
The data can see in a consistent fashion every game that every player's played, and scouts just can't do that. So the two things blend together. Data's got the breadth and the sort of objective power that a scout doesn't have. The scouts are still needed for the details, the things not included in the data. When it comes to players that I like the players who scouts had overlooked or other clubs had overlooked because they weren't perfect players. So Mo Salah wasn't perfect because he'd failed at Chelsea, but that's because Eden Hazard was one of the best players in the world at the time. So, of course, you're not going to get on the pitch if Eden Hazard is starting in your position. But everyone agreed he was a great player. He's like one level to watch, brilliant skills. The players I liked more were the players who didn't look that great to watch. Players like Joel Matip was a free transfer from Schalke. He's not the most elegant player.
Looks like a giraffe.
Yeah, he sometimes looks like he's not really in full control of the ball or his limbs. But what we saw from the data was he was really, really effective at winning back possession, really effective at carrying the ball forward and making impressive passes out of defence. And the opponents let him because they thought he wasn't as good as the data showed him to be. And, you know, he was a consistent starter for Liverpool in that Champions League winning season, started the Champions League final for us. It was a player where the data kind of saw something that other people didn't. And then the other players were players who'd suffered relegations and again had this, there was subjective bias against them. They can't be very good because the team you played on was one of the worst in the league last season. So people couldn't separate out what the player was doing from how bad the team was. And Andy Robertson, Gini Wijnaldum, they played, got relegated. We signed them immediately after relegation. Yeah.
Compare that for us, Rob, with the world of Formula One. I mean, how does a Formula One team analyse data from drivers? You know, we're seeing a new wave of drivers now coming into Formula One for 2025. A lot of younger drivers coming in, which is really exciting. Quite a few rookies. But I mean, You look across junior categories, you look what they're doing as far back maybe as karting, I guess. But how does someone like Mercedes, for example, know that Kimi Antonelli has what it takes? I know he's tested their car and everything else, but how can you be sure that It's a big risk. You're only actually putting one person or two people in your team, whereas a Premier League team has a squad of 25, 30 players. You've only got two that have got to deliver for you. So compare how Formula One works from a recruitment point of view.
Well, I think actually listening to Ian there, there's a lot of similarities. I think the one principal difference, but also a similarity listening to players who are in bad teams, let's say, is what our biggest challenge is to sanitize the data of the driver away from the car.
Yeah.
Because the car is so dominant, right? And the car has been dominant throughout Formula One. The machine is dominant. Now, if you put a certain driver in a dominant car or in a good car, you can get dominance, right? So what is the effect of the driver? I'm looking at Michael Schumacher over there on the back wall, one of my old colleagues. You know, he was, would Ferrari have been as dominant in the period when I was there without Michael? Without a doubt not. Would Red Bull have been as dominant without Max over these last few years? Without a doubt not. Same with Lewis and Mercedes, so on and so forth. But how do you separate out the driver from what they're doing compared to the car? That's very hard. And I would say that even though we deploy deploy traditional methodologies, we will overlay that with some kind of stochastic, like statistical view on it. We are now, AI is becoming much more prevalent, machine learning, trying to understand what the car's doing compared to what the driver's doing. It's still hard. It's still hard, but it gives us that, as Ian said, it gives us a very, at least we're starting to get a much more subjective view. You know, I think when I was at Williams, we started to build this out because we wanted to look for drivers who were effectively what's the best bang for buck, right? You can go out and you can go and buy somebody who is in Formula One terms is going to cost you $40 to $50 million a year on a retainer. You know that they're going to be good. Teams like Williams can't afford to do that. So can you look back at either the back of the grid, where definitely there's a bias towards, that driver's always last. And I think I can give you a classic example of that is Valtteri Bottas. If you look at what Valtteri Bottas does in that car this year, all of his stats, all of the data markers show objectively that he is still a very good, very fast driver. But of course,
he's not got any points because he's in a poor car.
Because he's in the worst car on the grid, and I hope Sauber don't mind me calling it the worst car on the grid. It is objectively that. He hasn't scored any points. And therefore, if you look, next year he's going to be out of a drive. So I don't think that... It probably brings me to a point that data is not being used for the driver in a strong enough way. It still has a lot of power. But so the question was, how did Mercedes pick Kimi Antonelli? It's a massive dose of, and again, it's very similar to what Ian was talking about with football and Liverpool there. It's a massive dose of blending the data of understanding what you can understand with what the scouts do. So we do have scouts in Formula One, or we have talent scouts, whatever they are. They'll usually start at the karting level, but again, they have a very subjective and I would say narrow view, because there's only a certain amount of data that they can assimilate in their own mind. Go and watching a driver on the track. I do it now at go-kart races. I watch drivers on the track and you say that driver's good, right? He is subjectively and hopefully objectively good. There's no doubt about it watching that kid. Okay, but then how do the stats line up? And I think a really important stat for Formula One, and you touched on it, or a really important data marker for Formula One, a really important insight, is consistency and how a driver performs under pressure.
Yeah.
Because the point that you made is so true. You've only got two of them. Yeah. Right. So if you get it wrong on one of them,
well, that's 50... there's teams that can have that right now, don't
they? There's teams that are suffering that today.
Yeah.
So if you get it wrong, that's world championships lost, or that's, you know,
yeah,
third position lost down to fifth position, whatever it is, because there's only one of your drivers delivering. So it's so critical. And how do you, what are the important insights that you need to draw out of the data in order to understand that? It's consistency. It's delivering under pressure. It's delivering. There's certain situations, like, you know, you're being followed, and, you know, one of the data markers that we look at, you're being followed, you're in a slower car for whatever reason, or your machine is slower than the driver behind. Maybe it's tire degradation, maybe it's natural pace of the car, whatever it is. How do you react? How many times do you get overtaken? That's a really, really critical data marker, because what it shows is something that we can't measure, is what's the psychological makeup of the driver? How do they react under certain situations? How many times can they overtake? You know, what sort of pace differential does a driver need to overtake? All of these are super important. And I think, you know, Mercedes, I can't speak for Mercedes because I don't work for them. But I guess, I hope that they've drilled down into all of these markers, and that's how they've arrived at Kimi. Certainly Kimi, up until, I would say, this year in Formula 2, all of his markers were so consistent, all of the insights that you could draw from what he'd done in his junior career, he was way ahead of the curve on most of them, and I guess that's the bet they've taken with him.
It's interesting. I mean, the driver who's likely to win F2 this year, Bortoleto, is a very good driver. He won F3 in his first year last year. So he ticks the boxes like Piastri did and like Leclerc did and what have you. But it's very interesting to me that they've also picked drivers, other teams have picked drivers who aren't necessarily top of the pops in F2, like Behrmann has got his drive, you know, Jack Doohan has got his drive, etc. So that's quite encouraging. Rather suggests to me that this data piece is driving a lot of this decision making, as much as just looking at the actual race results and the championship table. Let's move the conversation on to from recruitment to development, because in a football team and in a Formula One team, development is massively important. You know, you've got your team of players together now, you've got your manager, you've got, you know, you've got the championship starts. You want to be better by the end of the season than you were at the start. In Formula One terms, if we were to take the cars now back to the first track of the season, which is Bahrain, they would be about 2 seconds a lap faster than they were back in March, wouldn't they, Rob?
Some of them.
So, yeah, they should be. So that's kind of development on that side. And obviously the drivers, you know, hone their skills and stuff along the way. But how does that work in football in terms of what you, as from a data point of view, can tell the team and tell the coaches to make that team make those constant steps and develop through a season?
Yeah, game to game, it's hard, and data still has got a lot more to do with that. I'd say looking at a slightly longer time scale for development, the importance of data has been in squad composition and squad development season to season rather than game to game. So you can look at aging curves of players. Young players quite often are not the best performing players on a team. Well, think of the superstar teenagers like Kylian Mbappe, but that's not the normal trajectory of a player. Most players struggle when they're 18, 19, just breaking into the team, struggle to make that transition into the from youth football, which is a much easier environment and an easier context, into senior football. But as they learn the senior game, come to their physical peak, that means their performance generally increases. And then as they become mature professional, maybe physically they're not quite at their peak anymore, but they've got enough experience to maximise their physical capabilities. And
you can see all this.
Yeah, and what data helped us to do was, and really it was something that came from Fenway, Liverpool's owners, because they've been through a very similar story with baseball, which is an easier sport to measure using data. And one of the learnings from baseball was, don't sign old players. Or if you sign old players, don't spend too much money on them. Because what you want to sort of lock in the increasing performance. As a player goes from 21 to 24 to 27, typically they're improving their performance and reaching a peak. If you sign a 24-year-old player, you've got the opportunity after 2 years to say, okay, here's a big contract. We're going to we're going to get your peak years of performance, or you've got the opportunity to say, well, maybe some other club wants to pay us a transfer fee to sign.
And you've got a real premium on them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we had one of the youngest squads for many seasons at the start of Jürgen's reign, in that sort of 2015-2016 season. And the results weren't great yet, but similar to Rob's point about the, you know, the good drivers in bad cars, this was a very young team, not quite generating the results yet, but we could see if that trend continues, as there's proof of that happening in past seasons across many teams and players. That set of 24-year-olds today should be great when they're 26, 27 years old. So that sort of squad planning, having the right mix of experience and youth to keep on bringing through improving performance, that's the really important strategic part. On the week-to-week performance, video is still king. When it comes to football, it's the language that coaches and players understand. Hardly ever show a spreadsheet to a player or a coach. You just take the insights from the spreadsheet and find the relevant clips on video for them to understand, you know, what a particular opponent is good at, bad at. Set pieces is one place where it's easier to say things with data because it's a more controlled situation. The problem with football is there are no controlled situations, and if you're a scientist, you need some controlled situations to kind of say something about what's happening.
It's interesting actually that, because I guess the peak years of a footballer, what you're saying, is kind of 26, 27 to kind of early 30s, depending on the physical condition, I guess, injuries and stuff like that. But you're not wanting to give a big contract to a player that who's 32, 33 years old. I know Liverpool certainly don't want to do that. In Formula One, what I'm seeing, Rob, is you've got these kids coming in now, and Antonelli would be an example. Behrmann is a perfect example. He got parachuted into a Ferrari at the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix at like a few hours' notice, having missed the practice sessions. But because he'd done so many hours on the simulator and knew so much from a data point of view about how the Ferrari worked, he had driven around the track in an F2 car earlier in the weekend. So But he knew the lie of the land. But obviously, it all happens a lot faster in an F1 car when you step up. So that's actually probably a hindrance more than a help, I think, the fact that he'd been in an F2 car. But for me, it looks like these kids can come in now because they are so well prepared, because of things like simulation tools and all the data. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, definitely. I think the sport has become much more, for a driver, has become much more professional. So, you know, you look at like how these kids are getting prepared in go-karts. You know, there's a huge amount of money being spent on them. They get treated and fated almost like mini Formula One drivers from like 8, 9 years old. So they get set on this path and they learn a lot of the traits. Then technology, which is like highly important that you've just alluded to, is simulator technology. You know, we spent a long time building, you know, quasi-static simulation, dynamic simulation. But the thing that we always struggled with, in order to model the vehicle or the race or whatever it was the driver model, you know. And back in the day, if you go back into the late 90s when all this kicked off, you know, we were trying to use neural networks to kind of understand what the driver would do and what the driver
behavior
was. What's
a neural network?
It's old-fashioned language for machine learning, for artificial intelligence. So we were trying to kind of build a model of a driver to model their behavior to see what they would do, how they would drive the car in certain situations, certain elements and certain aspects of the race or certain grip levels. You know, how does the driver react? Because obviously a simulation model reacts always in the same way. So we never quite got to grips with that. So we did the next best thing of actually putting the driver in the loop. So the DIL, as it's called, the acronym is the DIL. That just means the driver is in the simulation loop. So we have a full-sized car that the driver sits in, a full-sized chassis that is moved about and is actuated. Hopefully, you know, most of the genius of driver-in-the-loop simulators is reducing the phase lag between what the driver sees and senses as to what the vehicle does.
Well, that's why some of the older drivers got sick, because like Raikkonen and Schumacher couldn't cope with it because they hadn't grown up with it and they used to get physically sick, didn't they?
Well, I think technology back then, I can remember Michael trying it for like the first few times and Michael hated it, but that was because, you know, we had like 300 million seconds like phase lag. We're now down to like, you know, like 5 milliseconds or something. Like the drivers can't perceive that. Nobody can perceive like a 5 millisecond phase lag between what you sense and what you see. It's so minuscule. So, you know, there's that really needed a whole explosion in electronics and hydraulics to be able to control systems to be able to do that. But what it means is that we now have so drivers as young as 14 are getting in something that certainly feels and looks to a certain extent very, very similar to what they're gonna feel when they're on track. You know, they don't quite get all of the they don't quite get all of the accelerations and the loads on their body, but they certainly get the sensation of speed. And you go somewhere like Saudi Arabia, sensation of speed at the Jeddah Corniche circuit is incredible. You know, it's lined with barriers. It's this wild, like left right massive G on your body. If you've just got ahead of that because you know what's coming up, then it puts you in such a stronger position to understand. And then you've got to kind of do all the other things that real life's thrown at you, like all the loads on your body, the heat, you know, the exhaustion that you don't get in the driving loop simulator. So I think that's one area of technology where Formula One has really excelled and accelerated in the last, I would call it 15 years, probably 20 years, in fact. 20 years where we've really started to get this right. And that's why I think you're seeing these really young guys come through who can just jump in the car and drive it straight away.
I mean, we're talking there about specifically about preparation for a race or for a match. I mean, I know a lot of the preparation in a football match is video clips and looking at the weakness of the opposition team around defending corners or how they tend to deploy certain positions and stuff like that. But how are you able to help a team when you're sort of preparing for the next match? What's the equivalent of what Rob's just said in the football world?
Yeah, it's nowhere near as developed as what Rob explained, and something like that in football would be outstanding. I think the technology is coming. So we trialled something at Anfield where we get tracking data for each game, so you see the trajectories of all the players running around the pitch. One of the data providers could provide something called voxels, I think, which are 3D pixels, which will effectively allow you to sort of look from any point on the pitch to any other point to put players in someone else's shoes or in their own shoes if you're reviewing their past performances. And so you can look around to say, well, why didn't you pick the pass for the runner that we trained, the, you know, when we received the ball in this position, the fullback will overlap. And in principle, the player can look around or the coach can look around and say, well, okay, he was covered. The pass wasn't actually on. It wasn't as easy as, the opposition successfully put a defender there so that we couldn't execute our plan. Our models will give an opinion on games that have just happened of, was the pass on? What was the best decision?
Yeah.
The best decision is obviously different for different players. So a 40-yard diagonal ball to Mo Salah might be the best decision if you're a really skillful passer. If you're a less skillful passer, your chance of making that pass is that much lower, and therefore an easier pass is the right thing for you to do. So we can give an opinion on all of that stuff. Typically, we did it post-match rather than preparation for the next game, the sort of tactical preparation of how the coach wants to set up against a given opponent. We can help with that. To be honest, Jürgen was quite a traditional approach. He had his way of playing, which was a really successful way of playing. I certainly didn't want to step in and complicate that way of playing. That
you don't want to get on the wrong side of him.
It might not be any better than his. You know, he's quite a good coach. He can plan the approach to the next game pretty well. I think some money was left on the table there.
Yeah.
But it's much more difficult to say game to game, how are we going to set up? We've also got the problem that I think you made the point, or someone made the point about F1, that it's like the driver against the track as much as it's the driver against the other drivers.
Yeah.
In football, you're really against the other team. And certainly for Liverpool, but I think for every team, how they play against you will not be the same as they play against other teams. Mm. And so that game theory element, and it's basically a gamble of, are we going to play in the same way as we always play? Or do we think this team's going to set up differently against us? But do they know that we think they're going to set up differently against us? And does that change their setup in this game? At Liverpool, our data analysis wasn't to the point where we could run that game theory sort of, well, are they going to do something new or do something novel in this game?
Well, maybe this is something you could talk to Rob about and bring some of the F1 know-how into football. But just developing that a little bit, I mean, you make that point that one of the big differences between the two sports is that in Formula One, the players all play each other every single week, every fortnight, whatever the races are, 24 times a year, let's call it. But they do it on completely different terrains, from Monaco, which is bumpy, tight, lined with barriers, to someone like Silverstone or Spa, you know, which is high speed, open, modern Formula One circuit. Whereas in football, you play obviously half your games at home and half your games in different, but there's still the pitch is a pitch, right? Very similar. There's not a huge difference between the quality of the grass, but the opposition is completely different every single time. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about some of those differences. I mean, I think the first thing that springs to mind for me is the complexity, Rob. There's an awful lot of complexity from a Formula One point of view.
Yeah, there is. But then if I think about Ian's job compared to my job, there isn't as well. Because like, if I think of playing, you know, you work for a team, so you're trying to optimize the position of those two drivers, but you've only got 18 other players that you're playing against. So I think, you know, if you take the difference in the pitch, if you like, so there's a different pitch 24 times a year, that's really a very technical exercise. It's a very technical exercise of both machine and human. So you're trying to optimize the vehicle. You know that your vehicle, you know, parametric optimization for Silverstone, for example, like what you mentioned, which is very wide open, very, very fast, you know, very flowing circuit, is very, very different to how you would optimize for Monaco. But then you've got to put the driver in the loop as well. You know, the driver has to get into a completely different mindset. So they would never drive the car in Monaco like they would drive it in Silverstone. If you drove the car in Silverstone like you did in Monaco, you'd end up with a very damaged car, probably without any of the corners left on it, because they drive it like a go-kart. You've got it's so tight and twisty, and you've got to set the car up like a go-kart as well. You know, you've got to put it, it's got a lot of oversteer. If it's got understeer, like as in the car won't turn, when you turn the steering wheel, it won't get to the corner, you won't be in good shape in Monaco. And the other extreme in Spa or in Silverstone, it's vice versa. If you set it up like a go-kart, you'd end up having a massive accident. It's just too hard to drive.
So is it the case that there are certain drivers or certain cars that are really good at Monaco but not so good at Silverstone?
Well, it's a good question, actually, Ian, because I had this fairly, I wouldn't say early on, well, yeah, early-ish on in my career, that when Felipe Massa came to us in Ferrari, and I was the, like, in Formula One, so he was like the lead engineer on his car. And he said to me, he made a statement that he said, look, I think I can be quick everywhere, but I can't be quick in Monaco. And it was a whole data-driven exercise that actually got him to 2 years later pole position and almost winning the race in Monaco. Yeah. And that was because effectively we went to Monaco in that first year in 2006, and he was on the results. You know, if you just take a blanket result and even sector times, he was pretty terrible. And I think Michael had, you know, won the race at a canter. If he hadn't won the race at a canter, Michael Schumacher, his teammate, he was certainly high up. And the team came away from that race quite perplexed by it, because he was fast everywhere. And you think, well, it's okay, it's tight and twisty, but it's just a track, right, with corners and straights. So then you start to drill into the data and you start to look at all of the various metrics and KPIs, what drive performance. And you say, well, actually, they're all there. He just doesn't put it together. So we kind of spent this, and you only go there twice, you know, between 2006 and 2008. We only went there another two times, so you don't have a lot of time to practice. But using simulation techniques, using the driver in the loop simulator, we actually ended up there 2 years later being the fastest car. And that was a very, very data-driven exercise. So you do get drivers who kind of, I think it's more of a psychological thing.
Mm.
You know, when you come up against, maybe the same in football, you come up against a certain player and
definitely,
and you just like kind of, you know, you go to pieces, for want of a better word. And then there's others where you feel like more confidence. We are dealing with athletes at the end of the day, right? You're dealing with human beings who are athletes. And I guess you get that like entirely in football as well, probably more so than
F1. Absolutely. I think that different, I think like a lot of these points have been about the context, and when the context changes, how does that change someone's performance?
Yeah.
So in football, you play against a big team and it'll be both sides trying to win the game and playing an open game of football. And that's the sort of game that top players like to play in. And then you go away to Sean Dyche's Burnley, was always the team that we had problems with. And you know, they're just not interested in coming out of their own half. And the players don't like playing against that deep block. It's really difficult to do. The sort of automations that have been coached into them, our whole thing was win the ball back high, counter-attack, counter-press. Burnley aren't interested in that. They'll just kick the ball away rather than try and bring the ball out of defence. And, you know, credit to Sean Dyche, it was the right way to play against Liverpool.
Yeah, otherwise it'd be a telephone number score, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but you know, great players would struggle in those circumstances, maybe in a similar way to your Monaco story. And with football, especially sort of middle-of-the-table teams, they have it hardest in many ways. If you're Burnley, really small budget, just defending in every game, that's an okay strategy. Middle of the table teams, they have to sometimes be really defensive, because if you come and attack Liverpool and Manchester City, we're going to score lots of goals against you. But at the same time, you need 3 points against Burnley. So you've got some games where you have to attack, some where you have to defend, and you better be quite good at both of them if you want to stay in the league.
You mentioned strategy there, and I think that's the final topic I really wanted to get onto, because obviously data and being able to be on top of data is absolutely fundamental in Formula One to good decision making during a race. So you go into a Grand Prix, you know what tyre you're going to start on, you know where you're starting on the grid. What you don't know is when there might be a rain shower or when there might be a safety car. There are lots of events that happen, aren't there, Rob, in Formula One that a strategist sitting on the pit wall has to adapt and make very important decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can just talk maybe for a few minutes about that, just finally, comparing what you can do in the middle of a Formula One race with what you can do in the middle of a football match to change things based on what the data's telling you.
Well, I'd be really interested to hear like Ian's take on this and how football handles it, because everything that we do in, you know, we don't have a superstar coach like Jurgen Klopp, right, or Pep Guardiola, who obviously is there to motivate but make a lot of the decisions as well with his staff. Yes, we have senior people, but the decisions are so data driven. And when you talked about, you know, the use of game theory and before, you know, that's very, very prevalent in F1 now. You know, a lot of the tools and the simulation tools, race strategy tools, they're all proprietary, but most of them use the same methodologies. So it will be you would take a single output, which is driven by game theory. So driver or player X does this. What are you going to do? You know, conditions change to do this. What are you going to do? You know, and the model is constantly updating. Then what we would do is we overlay that. We take a statistical approach. So we would simulate that, you know, between 10,000 and 1,000,000 times per lap. So you've constantly got this stochastic approach, which is driven by game theory, but telling you what to do. So we don't have, you know, I think when I started in Formula One, it was kind of it was probably more analogous to what football is, because you had the very senior guy who sat on the pit wall, who'd probably seen more races than he'd, you know, had at dinners, let's say. And he kind of just made decisions on...
Like Ross Brawn back in the day.
Yeah, Ross was very much like that. When I got to kind of make it... When I got to Ross's position, sat on that pit wall, if you like, at Williams, I wanted to do everything driven by data because, yeah, of course, like, that's my background, right? So I wanted to do everything driven by data, and I set up the teams and we built the tools and we did everything so it was driven by data. I wanted to... I wouldn't want to say make an easy decision, but make the most informed decision that I can. But, you know, what was very clear was we would have a stochastic output and the most clear output of what it was going to look like before anybody started their engines on a Sunday morning. And we'd all sit round and we'd talk about that. As soon as the lights went out and the positions changed down at turn one and somebody spun out and there might be a safety car that comes out for two laps, you may as well rip that game plan up, right? And then you just refer back to what the tool's telling you. And you just kind of stay on top of that. And there might be, you know, there could be discussions about it where you bring experience into it and say, well, actually, at this track, this sometimes happens. Have we taken that into account in the modeling and the simulation? But most of the time, you're very reliant on that. But it would be really interesting to hear if, like, you could actually influence the match when it was in play. Because I would, you know, to me, that seems an obvious thing to do. But I've never been a football coach.
Yeah, the football coach certainly can, but that's today, that's the realm, that's absolutely the coach's decision. I think you can't do much. You can change your, you know, how attacking you're going to be, you can change your formation to, you know, address what the opposition's trying to do to you. But you've got five substitutes. That's the biggest change you can make, yeah, on the match. And I'd say, as a rule, coaches are too risk averse. When they're drawing a game, they need to win, or losing a game, they wait too long and don't go attacking enough when they make those changes. And there's some data to support that, but the data's not compelling enough to say, you know, it's overwhelming evidence you have to make these substitutions earlier.
Right.
And the reason for that is the sort of stochastic nature of football. It's fascinating you keep using that word, because I see Formula One as a much more controlled environment than football. The sort of nature of scoring a goal, if you look at how goals are distributed, they're Poisson distributed, which basically gives you a big hint that randomness is king. You know,
really,
teams quite often lose games they should have won and win games they should have lost. And it means that the signal is very weak compared to the noise. I say noise, you know, lucky things or unrepeatable things happen a lot in football games, to the point where it's difficult. I've got a lot of sympathy with the coach. It's very difficult for them to separate out, was this performance good? Were the decisions good? Separate that out from, did we win the game or not? Mm. And I guess you have those similar conversations in F1 to say, we finished eighth. Did we do everything right? Would we do the same thing again? You know, yep, what? We did as well as we could have done. But it's a very hard sell to a driver or a coach who's very, very upset that they haven't got the outcome right.
I think that's so true, because, and again, that's changed massively for me in Formula One over my time there, because we've become much more analytical and much more data driven. That you would finish a race in, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, and the team owner, team principal or whatever would be jumping up and down and saying, well, why, you know, we should have done better and all the rest of it. And it was very difficult to kind of, you know, at that point, I guess we didn't have the technology to be able to tell us, well, actually, we've optimized our, yeah, position. We've made all the right decisions. And that is such a dangerous, like, you know, a vicious circle to get into, that actually you've made all the right decisions, but the team doesn't understand they've made all the right decisions. And it just causes chaos, you know, yeah, that you see football teams and Formula One teams still to this day,
yeah,
they don't move out of, because they're just constantly sat in the chaos. So you say, well, there's this thing over here which is blocking us from having a result, but it's certainly not the decisions that I made today.
Mm.
You know, I made nine out of the 10 decisions that were made were all really sound decisions, and they were based on these tools or these methodologies that have helped us to do that. But I can, you know, even when you look back, and I was reading something the other day about, and I worked at one of these teams that punched above their weight. Mm. Did they really? Mm. Did they do that consistently, or were they just where they should have been? Mm. And I think when you look back, and we did this exercise in my business a couple of years back because I was really interested. You'll know the team I'm talking about, James. I didn't mention it because of Eddie. But you know, Eddie would constantly talk about we punched above our weight. We actually went back and looked at the performance of that car and looked at the performance of the drivers and put all that together and said, and some of the fortuitous situations of what the other people would do, what the other teams were doing as well, especially in that 99 year when Jordan very, very nearly won the Grand Prix. Actually, Jordan did what they should have done. And they should look back and be really proud that they were able to do that with not so much budget, but they did that with they were able to build a very good car and develop a really fast car. And Eddie was able to bring in drivers that perhaps, you know, would have been top drivers that should have been elsewhere. So in a way you can say, yeah, we punched above our weight, but it was almost like we used to take like this bag of nails to the track and like almost win with it. It wasn't the case at all. We were doing what we should have done with that car.
And finally, just to round us off, Ian, I mean, from what you've heard today and what you've sort of seen looking in on Formula One from the outside, what do you think the world of football in your particular domain, what do you think the world of football can learn from Formula One?
The one thing that really stood out, and you know, I'm pretty ignorant of Formula One and motorsports, has been an education listening to you and Rob. The one thing that really stood out was the development of young drivers from karting all the way through to Formula One. I think like the most difficult thing in football is predicting that development of academy players, the best under 16s and not the best under 21s, who are then not the best senior players. And so it's an eye-opener to hear that you can measure and predict to some certainty that, the kart and F3 drivers, if you measure them properly, that does give you some information about how they'd prosper in a Formula One car. It's the big unsolved question, partly because the data is just not there. Like, we could see our Liverpool team under 16 performances, but of course we weren't allowed to see. We could see the opponents that we played against, but we didn't have the wide data set that we've got for senior games. And when I say 3 years of good performance in Germany, that translates pretty well to the Premier League if you measure it properly. 3 years of good performance in youth football, you know, that can be Kylian Mbappe, or it can be a player who ends up playing in the third or fourth division. So that's somewhere where Formula One's light years ahead of football.
And the reverse for you, Rob, briefly, where do you think Formula One can learn from football?
I think that we are very obsessed about... we created a big data problem in Formula One before the term even existed in the early mid 90s. So I think we're very obsessed about we have to measure everything. But I think if you listen to what Ian's talked about today with football, I mean, I guess you guys have a minuscule data set compared to what we collect in Formula One, like as in your acquired data. But then I think these guys are, in terms of methodologies, probably, you know, there's a lot that Formula One could learn about those methodologies of using small data sets, but being able to generate lots of insight, because that's what we're all trying to do, right? We're trying to generate insight that makes our bosses or whatever, you know, our cars win races, our teams win matches. So I think there's overlap there that is definitely interesting.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I could talk to you guys for all day, but we have to round it up there. So thank you very much for coming. And remember to send in your questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on Twitter or X. My thanks to Rob Smedley, to Dr. Ian Graham. Don't forget to buy Ian's book, How to Win the Premier League. It's an absolute must to put its ticket in someone's Christmas stocking. And it's a fantastic read for anybody who likes football or any general sports fan. Make sure to follow all the behind-the-scenes F1 stories on Autosport and follow the Autosport podcast across next weekend's Las Vegas Grand Prix. My thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production, and thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review and a rating, and tell all of your F1 and football mad friends about us. Share it with one of them today. We love seeing new listeners discovering the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
Hi everyone, Dre Harrison here, producer behind the scenes of Autosport and the Motorsport Network. We've heard some of your feedback in regards to your podcast feed, and with that in mind, we're letting you know that we're splitting up our content going forwards. There are three new places for you to listen to all of our audio content as part of the Motorsport Network family. Now, if you're listening to us on Autosport F1, stay right here exclusively for all of our F1 content. News, previews and reviews, and weekly fan Q&As from our world-leading journalists in our studios in London and directly from the paddock. If you want more of the global motorsport scene, subscribe to our new feed, Autosport Racing, featuring analysis, news and reviews from the World Endurance Championship, the British Touring Car Championship and more. If you prefer the domestic scene for your motorsport coverage, you can subscribe to our new Autosport National podcast. Hosted by Autosport Editor-in-Chief Kevin Turner and National Reporter Stephen Licorice, the Autosport National podcast will feature rankings, opinions, the latest news and exclusive interviews from the beating heart of the domestic scene, including British GT, rallying, hill climb and the grassroots of domestic motorsport. We also have the Autosport Retro podcast. As Autosport crosses its 75th anniversary as a publication, what better way to celebrate our rich history than a trip through the archives? On Retro, we recount some of the greatest stories in motorsport, from drivers, teams, cars, brands, and more, and include sit-down interviews with key figures across motorsport history. Don't forget, we also have the James Allen and F1 podcast, with the award-winning broadcaster and journalist combining business analysis and F1 opinions, with in-depth sit-down interviews with some of the sport's biggest names, like Zak Brown, James Vowles, and Fred Vasser. And finally, bikes are back on the Motorsport Network. Tank Slappers will be returning with Uriel Podjamont, Ben Hunt, and a new lead host. Me! Hey, they can't all be winners. But we'll be giving you weekly podcasts on everything MotoGP as Marc Marquez and Pecco Bagnaia go head-to-head for the 2025 World Championship. All of these shows will be available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and everywhere else where all good podcasts are available. Thank you so much for listening and for all your ongoing support.